This podcast miniseries is supported by a grant from Takeda. Despite its rarity, hereditary angioedema, or HAE, has a profound impact on the lives of many patients. As healthcare providers, the ability to recognize and diagnose HAE early, especially in pediatric patients, can make all the difference in improving patient outcomes and quality of life. However, the challenges of diagnosing HAE, particularly in minority and rural populations, remain significant. The goal of this podcast miniseries, Pediatric Hereditary Angioedema, also known as HAE, Diagnosis and Management, Challenges, Barriers, Strategies, is to explore how we can overcome barriers from early recognition in childhood to managing long-term care and understanding the genetic and acquired forms of this disease. We'll also discuss the crucial role you play in identifying this condition before it's too late. Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Kristen Sokol, and I will be your host for this three-part mini-series entitled Pediatric Hereditary Angioedema Diagnosis and Management, Challenges, Barriers, Strategies. I'm a board-certified allergist immunologist and board-certified pediatrician practicing at Schreiber Allergy in the DC area, and currently serving as the chair of the ACAAI Annual Program Committee. In this episode, we will discuss the challenges of managing HAE, including treatment differences in rural versus urban settings, barriers to care, and the importance of shared decision-making for treatment plans. We will hear about effective strategies for on-demand home therapy administration. And then in the third and final episode, we will discuss long-term management strategies for HAE, when to start prophylaxis, and how to help pediatric patients with HAE transition into adulthood. I'm excited to be joined by two HAE experts. Our first expert is Dr. Jonathan Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein is a professor of medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Department of Internal Medicine in the Division of Rheumatology, Allergy, and Immunology, and partner of Bernstein Allergy Group and Bernstein Clinical Research Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is the immediate past president of the QuadAI and also serves on the medical advisory board for the U.S. Hereditary Angioedema Association. Dr. Bernstein, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kristen. I'm happy to be here.
Our second expert is Dr. Timothy Craig. Dr. Craig is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and biomedical sciences, and is a distinguished educator at Pennsylvania State University. He is also a senior advisor at Vinh Mek International Hospital in Thaim City, Hanoi, Vietnam. He is director of the Allergy, Immunology, and Respiratory Clinical Research, as well as the PSU Alpha 1 Foundation Clinical Resource Center and the International Angioedema Resource Center, also known as ACARE. He also serves on the Medical Advisory Board for the U.S. Hereditary Angioedema Association. Dr. Craig, welcome back to the show. I'm so glad you could join us again.
Yes, so am I. Thank you so much, Kristen.
All right, let's dive in. Tim, we can start with you. We know that rural counties in the United States have fewer specialists, fewer emergency facilities, and fewer transportation options than most urban areas. How does this specifically affect the treatment of HAE?
Yeah, so I'd like to talk about three different disparities. The first one is exactly what you said by area. There's less specialists out in rural areas, also in inner city areas. So both those populations tend to have less access to allergists, and especially allergists that have knowledge about hereditary angioedema. And so the diagnosis is more difficult and the treatment often is not as good as it is in more suburban type areas. And that's been shown by a colleague of ours, Mark. But there's also a disparity in minorities versus the majority. And we know that the delay in diagnosis, the amount of doctors you have to see, is greater in those that are from minority groups than from the majority group. Also, the disparity around the world. So in foreign countries, they don't have, or in many countries throughout the world, those of low and medium income do not have access to the functional assay, and which makes it difficult to confirm a diagnosis for the type 2 HAE. Remember, they have normal protein and a low C4, and so you would think they don't have HAE unless you have that functional assay showing that it's abnormally low. So that's not only disparity of diagnosis in low and medium income countries, but also there's decreased access to treatment. Most of the therapies we have in the United States are not available. In fact, if you go to Vietnam and most other countries in the world, they have nothing other than androgen and fresh frozen plasma to treat these people, unfortunately. So there's a lot of disparities from rural to suburban, from majority to minority, as well as from high-income countries to lower middle-income countries.
Thank you so much, Tim. And that was an important point, just adding about international diagnoses of this condition. And, you know, in the first episode of this podcast, we really dove into kind of how to identify these patients, right? So that's the first step. And in these rural areas of our country and other countries that might not have access to the treatment, hopefully we can teach the pediatricians and the specialists how to really identify this early. So we also know that providing HAE patients with on-demand home therapies is very important, and all patients with HAE should have an emergency plan for the treatment of attacks. So Jonathan, can you tell us the significance of this type of treatment?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Before I do, I want to just comment on Tim's previous comment about access to diagnostic tests. And there have been some progress made on developing dried blood spot assays for functional assays for this very purpose, where underserved populations in countries around the world could actually have the opportunity of just putting a drop of blood on a card and send it into a central lab and have that diagnosis made. So we are making progress in trying to solve some of these disparities. Regarding on-demand therapy, again, it's essential that any patient with a diagnosis of HAE has this available, because attacks, acute swelling episodes, can happen spontaneously, although in many cases there may be a prodrome and patients might actually have subtle symptoms that would predict the beginning of an attack, like a characteristic skin eruption called erythema marginatum. But it's really important for patients to have these therapies to prevent the progression of an attack and to allow that, not disrupt their lives unnecessarily, whether it's work, leisure, and so forth. It's recommended that patients have at least two doses, because sometimes the first dose doesn't always work, but in many cases it is effective, but just to have an extra dose available. Patients who are on prophylactic therapy, and usually they're on prophylactic therapy because they have had more frequent attacks or more severe attacks, or the location of the attack is in a more severe area, such as the throat, even if they are on prophylaxis, they can have breakthrough attacks and need to be prepared for an acute episode. So I think it's also been shown that when they use these treatments early in the onset of an attack, within the first 30 minutes, this actually prevents the severity of the attack significantly. So in summary, everybody with HAE should have an on-demand treatment. They should treat the attack as early as possible, as soon as they recognize it, that it's occurring. And the patients, regardless of whether they're on prophylactic or not, should have on-demand therapy available.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. So important. So we've really heard about how important it is to identify this early and to have on-demand therapy for these patients. So Tim, can you talk about how is it that on-demand home therapy is administered? Are there different techniques?
Yeah, so there are. So right now, as Jonathan said, everybody should have two rescue. Some of the rescue IV, which is handicapped, especially if it's your parents and you have a young child with it, because you can't expect a parent to do an IV on their three-year-old. But you know, in the past, before we had sub-Q, we were teaching 8-year-olds had it self-infused. So it's possible that at any age, someone could give an IV on-demand therapy for attacks. But right now, I think the majority of people are using the sub-Q route. Mainly, it's icatibant, and it's a generic medication. And I would say probably about 75% of my patients now are using a sub-Q. There are some oral medications being looked at right now in research, but you know, we don't expect them around for another year or two. But that's going to be a big addition to the field, because 25% of Americans don't like needles. They have needle phobia. So those are people that tend to wait a longer time before they use icatibant or one of the other medications for rescue. So it's going to be a really nice thing to have, such as Jonathan said, if someone uses a medication very, very early on, the duration of the attack and the severity attack are less. So that's really an oral medication would be definitely an advantage. But right now, the main is, as I said, is icatibant, which is sub-Q. And, you know, almost anybody can self-administer, and that's what we expect. I do want to add one thing, though. If you have an upper airway attack, you treat yourself with your rescue medication, and you really should go to the emergency room. And the reason I'm saying that is I just lost a patient a few months ago who gave himself the dose at home, the icatibant. He went back to bed. He woke up. He still had some symptoms. He gave himself a second injection instead of going to the emergency room, which he would bring his second injection. But then he gave himself the second injection and then had it asphyxia and died shortly thereafter. So really, I think for abdominal attacks, skin attacks, you don't need to go to the emergency room. But if you have an airway, I really do think you should give your first injection and get care in case your symptoms don't resolve.
Thank you so much, Tim. And what a tragic story you tell of your patient who recently passed away. I'm so sorry to hear that. But this is, you know, what we deal with when we're treating patients with this disease that can be fatal. We've touched on this, but Jonathan, we've heard and the literature has shown that there's often a delay in diagnosis for many patients with HAE. So how can this impact a patient's care specifically?
Well, quite significantly. Actually, Tim's story is quite sobering. I just wanted to make a comment about the on-demand therapy is that a lot of times I've had a situation where a patient went to an emergency room who didn't have on-demand therapy, thinking that the emergency room had the treatment readily available. And emergency rooms do not stock these treatments. So it's very important that patients have these treatments on their person, use them and go to the emergency room, because the same kind of unfortunate event happened to a patient who left AOA against the physician advice because they didn't have on-demand therapy. And these are unnecessary situations if we can get our patients to listen to this advice that Tim basically gave in his last response. So yeah, I think that it has a great impact on people's lives. Needless to say, people walk around there having unexplained abdominal attacks. They're having swelling. It's quite disfiguring. It impacts their work. It impacts their leisure and also creates quite a bit of anxiety and concern about their well-being. 75% of patients with HAE have a family history. So they know that a family member has had HAE. So they should actually be screened very early on, and they should know if they're going to have a diagnosis of this condition and get and seek treatment. And I think it was mentioned earlier that even if they haven't had an attack, they should still have on-demand therapy readily available, because you never know when the onset will occur, even though literature says of age 11, the average age, patients have it. So I think it's important to be prepared. But it does impact the patient's care. And it's important to note that 25% of patients have no family history. 25% of patients have a de novo mutation that will lead to HAE. So these individuals may not know what's going on. And it's very important that physicians, whether they're primary care or emergency department, gastroenterologists, and of course, allergists and immunologists, have a clear understanding of the differential diagnosis of isolated angioedema and screen these patients when they do present. Most patients won't have hereditary angioedema, but one still needs to screen patients who present with isolated angioedema to exclude this problem. And that's the way we can actually impact their health, by diagnosis, by getting them on the right treatment plan. And it's amazing when you treat these patients how impactful you can be in terms of their personal lives, their work careers, and overall, they're just, you know, happiest clams. They're very satisfied with the treatments that we currently have available to treat this disease.
You're so right, Jonathan, and you've really touched on the quality of life of these patients and how it's affected as a young child all the way into adulthood. And if we can identify, diagnose this disease early, give them the treatments that we have early, teach them how to use them, right? This is so important. And speaking of quality of life, treatment plans are going to differ based on the patient preferences. So Tim, in your experience, are there specific HAE treatments or treatment plans that are preferred by patients? I know you mentioned a little bit about IV versus sub-Q on-demand therapy, but anything else that you can talk about? And how do you address this if it differs from your standard of care?
Well, let me back up first of all. So everybody has to have their rescue medication, as Jonathan and Alina talked about. Everybody should have short-term on therapy for prophylaxis, for surgical procedures, dental procedures, and so on. And now what you're referring to is long-term prophylaxis. And not everybody is suitable for long-term prophylaxis, but if someone's having frequent attacks, it becomes an automatic. But even people who have mild attacks, if they have a lot of anxiety, if they have a lot of depression, if they have a post-traumatic stress syndrome from having attacks younger in life, that might be another reason why a person should be put on prophylactic medication for long-term suppression of attacks. Our ideal situation is for people to have no attacks at all, but sometimes people do have attacks, and sometimes having questionnaires of quality of life and so on may help you determine how the disease is impacting that patient. In a sense of type of medications now, we have IV, we have sub-Q, monoclonals, and then we have a bunch of new research drugs coming out over the next couple of years. And so right now, the medications, there's a oral medication you can take for prophylaxis, it's once a day. There's a sub-Q medication that's every 2 to 4 weeks that tends to be very effective. There's IV C1 inhibitor that can be used, but that has to be given every 3-4 days. And then there's sub-Q C1 inhibitor as well, but that also has to be given every 3 to 4 days. So there's a difference not only in the drug burden. So, you know, some people want to be on the protein that's deficient or defective and thus choose to go on C1 inhibitor, even though there's a bigger burden of therapy, while other people prefer the monoclonal antibodies because they're given less frequently, and others the oral medication because it's easy to take. And in the future, we're probably going to have sub-Q medications that are going to be given maybe every 2 months, maybe every 3, maybe even every 6 months, which will be a big advance. And also there's oral medications that are going to be much more effective than the oral medication out there. And then we might even have CRISPR technology where possibly you get one injection and it lasts for many, many years, maybe a life. We don't know. We're in phase, going into phase 3s now, so we'll find that out. But it's a really exciting area in the sense for the person, because there's going to be such a great choice of different medications by different routes, include an oral route, and by different duration of action, which may be down to maybe once in your lifetime. So it is a really exciting area. And as a patient, I think we have such a positive future for patients as well as their children. So let me again talk about strictly pediatrics. Here I was talking about all age groups. For pediatrics, icatibant is not approved. In Europe it is, but in the United States, the limit is 18 years of age and above. There is ecallantide, which is an injectable medication. That is approved to 12 and above. The concerns with that is a nurse or a healthcare provider needs to go to the home to inject the person, or the person has to come to a physician or an emergency room. So the use of ecallantide is minimal. There's also C1 inhibitor, which is intravenous, which makes it difficult to use at home. So for young kids, they really need to go to the emergency room, usually to have that injected. But older children and teenagers obviously could get an intravenous injection for their attacks. For prophylaxis, there is a drug that's now approved down to age 2 is lanadelumab. It is a sub-Q medication. There's another sub-Q medication that's sub-Q C1 inhibitor. And then there's also IV C1 inhibitor that can be used in children and is FDA approved. So right now, I think the biggest addition, though, is to have lanadelumab down to the age of 2 because it's sub-Q and it has a very little burden. It is used every 2 weeks to every 4 weeks.
Thank you so much, Tim. Yeah, I mean, having options for patients seems really important in this disease. It just affects their quality of life and obviously can be severely life-threatening. So to have options and to kind of work through that with your patients, I think is something we can definitely do for our patients. And it can be very rewarding as an allergist to care for these patients. And as Jonathan said, once you get them on that therapy and they're free of attacks, they're happy as clams, right? So thank you so much to our two experts for sharing their valuable insights today. There are certainly challenges in the management of HAE, including identifying treatment differences, the barriers to care, and deciding on treatment plans for our individual patients with this condition, as well as identifying effective strategies for on-demand home therapy administration. We hope this discussion has provided our listeners with practical guidance to overcome these challenges. This concludes part 2 of our 3-part mini-series, Pediatric Hereditary Angioedema Diagnosis and Management, Challenges, Barriers, Strategies from the ACAAI. Don't miss part 3 when we cover long-term management strategies, when to start prophylaxis, and how to help pediatric patients with HAE transition into adulthood. For other interesting podcast episodes and to claim CME for this episode, please visit education.acaai.org/allergytalk. I'm Kristen Sokol for the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. Have a wonderful day.